One of the things frequently pointed out about the internet is that you can be anonymous there. You can say really nice things or truly awful things, and nobody knows who you are. Likewise, there's anonymity among the people who created it and improved it. I mean, how many people can you name who are instrumental in making the internet what it is today? We learn about one of the key figures and the people around him in the book No Better Time, The Brief Remarkable Life of Danny Lewin, the Genius Who Transformed the Internet. Molly Knight Raskin is the author of the book. She's a journalist with a long list of credits ranging from PBS documentaries and the NewsHour to Scientific American and Psychology Today, and she's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Molly, thank you for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Had you even heard of Danny Lewin when you first got put on this story in 2011 or so?
I had never heard the name. I knew nothing about him, and the story was just entirely new to me.
Is it the kind of a thing where you pull a thread and it just keeps going and going and going?
That's exactly what it was like. You know, I first heard about Danny Lewin really in conversation with a friend, and it was a friend of a friend, and he said, you know, there's this story of this young man, and I know someone who's always wanted to tell it but just hasn't found the right person to do so, but 10 years has passed. And then the more I heard about his story, it piqued my interest. I just heard little bits and pieces, and I went home and I started doing some research, and it was just like that. It just suddenly started to unfold before my eyes, and I almost couldn't believe what I was reading, and my immediate reaction was, why hasn't this story ever been told before? And then my gut reaction and response was, I'm telling it.
Well, there you go. You just got onto it from there. But so Danny's real contribution was he really made the internet a lot faster.
Yes, that's right. You know, as you mentioned at the start, we know, I mean, I think generally speaking, unless you work in technology or something related to the internet, you know, the general public knows very little about the inner workings of the internet. And there's many reasons for that. I mean, one of which is just that it's complicated and very complex and involves, in many cases, high-level math and engineering. But what Danny did in the 90s is very, not, you know, very well known, but was absolutely instrumental to the growth of the internet into what we know it as today. And that was to develop these algorithms. He was a student at MIT that essentially sped up the internet. So the real simple way of explaining it is just to really, an analogy I use in the book, which is that if the internet was at the time the Pony Express, what Danny invented, you know, as a student at MIT was essentially the Federal Express of the internet.
There was an moment for me as I read into the book and finally saw the name Akamai, because I remember years ago on some of the older browsers where you'd watch the little corner thing flicking, saying all the things it was doing, and it was contacting this and that and the other thing. The name Akamai always came in there, but that was what Danny created.
Exactly. And again, that's why so few people, I think, know of the company or know of his creation. And that's because, yes, I mean, to somebody who knows the internet or who may have noticed that web address pointing towards an Akamai server instead of a server of the company they're trying to reach may stop and scratch their heads and say, what is that? The company today controls at any moment 30% of the world's internet traffic, which is just a staggering amount of internet traffic. And, you know, the company is also responsible today for, you know, any of those major websites that you see online that we might use and take for granted every day, like Facebook or iTunes, that are so speedy and efficient, rely on that technology to stay live under great crushes of traffic every day.
So give us the background on Danny Lewin. He's an American, but an Israeli as well.
Well, Danny grew up, he's American. He was born and raised outside Denver, Colorado, and really up until his teenage years had a pretty pretty nice childhood. You know, two brothers, both parents doctors. Lived in a very nice suburb, enjoyed a lot of sports, skiing, mountain climbing. But from birth, he was exceptionally gifted, and this is something that his parents still talk about today. It wasn't just really the intellectual capacity, but it was also that he was born with what they say was just this innate drive, you know, just this sort of fierce curiosity, energy, always wanting to just take on things that were much bigger than himself from a very young age. And so, but then everything kind of came to a screeching halt when he was a teenager, and his father very abruptly announced that the family, or that he was moving the family to Israel. And, you know, Danny grew up in a Jewish home, but they weren't very strictly religious. And it was really his father who became more increasingly interested in Zionism and those ideals and values, and decided that Israel was a place that he wanted to raise his family. And Penny was furious about this. I mean, he was above average American teenager who was really enjoying his life right on the cusp of high school and sports and girls. And there he found himself in Israel, speaking no Hebrew and having no connections to the country really whatsoever.
And not a skinny computer guy by any stretch of the imagination. Apparently he skipped a lot of school and hung out at a place called Samson's.
That's right. Danny really kind of bucked the, took off the pedestal this idea that, you know, math and computer science geniuses are scrawny and hang out in the library and study all the time. And you know, in fact, even at MIT, people will tell you that stereotype is based in reality. In fact, there are a lot of students who are like that. But Danny was different. He was also really physically gifted, which, again, was unusual for somebody with his high level of, you know, math and science and intellectual capacity. But he was, I'm trying to say, you know, he's really built like a bull. Just all the muscle. Wasn't that tall, about 5'10", but really muscular and incredibly physically adept.
Physically adept and mentally adept as well. Much more to talk about Danny Lewin. He is the subject of Molly Knight Raskin's book, No Better Time. We'll come back and talk more with Molly and take your phone calls and emails if you'd like to join us. Back on the Jefferson Exchange in 1 minute. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on Jefferson Public Radio's News and Information Service. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Molly Knight Raskin, longtime journalist with a long list of credits to her name. Most recent is a book called No Better Time, The Brief Remarkable Life of Danny Lewin, the genius who transformed the Internet. He basically made it go faster. He figured out ways to do that through the company called Akamai. And you maybe have heard a little bit about it, but Molly gives us a much better idea of who Danny Lewin was before he died in the September 11th terrorist attacks. Join us on the Jefferson Exchange if you'd like at 800-838-3760, anywhere you can hear us. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So we're just talking about the fact that Danny was pretty much raw muscle in addition to a lot of brain power going on up there, too. And he was hanging out at the gym when his family moved to Israel. What impact did the time at the gym at Samson's have on his grades?
Well, you know, he was one of those infuriating students who could skip school and kind of cruise through and still get really good grades and still succeed and be one of the top students. And so, you know, one of his best friends often said he was always one step ahead of the truant officer. He didn't go to school all that often, but when he did, he managed to kind of sail through his classes, get his projects done really quickly. In a sense, I mean, school was easy for him. And he went to a technology high school in Israel, and so it definitely, you know, there were topics that he was interested in, but he was just truly gifted. I mean, he was building his first computers at home by the time he was, you know, 11, 12 years old. So school came easily to him, and I think, you know, just the frustration of moving to a new country and not knowing anybody and not knowing the language was incredibly difficult for him. And so one of the ways he dealt with that frustration was to go to a local gym, a gym that was very popular with both Americans and sort of tough Israeli soldiers, and spend a lot of time there and work himself physically into the best shape he could be. And it was really pivotal, I think, for him, because that is where he met a lot of young men who had served or were planning to serve in the Israeli army. And that's what led to the next step in his life, which was service in the Israeli army. So the gym was kind of his home away from home and a way that he could get away from his parents. He's pretty angry about the move to Israel. So he called it his, you know, his second home.
Some military service is required of most Israeli men, isn't it?
That's right. If you are a native-born Israeli, you are required to serve at age 18. It's compulsory military service in the country. So, but Danny was not required to serve. He was, as I mentioned, he was American-born. So he could have easily opted out of the military. Instead, he was, I think, really inspired by the stories that he heard of these, you know, heroic sort of Hollywood-like missions that these soldiers were going on. And he heard about them at the gym, and he decided that he not only was going to serve, but then went around telling people that he was going to serve in the most elite unit of the Israeli Defense Force, which at first really gave people kind of a chuckle, like, this guy is really brash, to think that he could ever make it into the unit, which is the most elite, secretive unit of the Israeli Army.
And the counterterrorism unit, this is sounds like it really took, you had to be that much better than the soldiers around you to be able to get into it.
Oh, I mean, the statistics are amazing. I write about it in the book, but, you know, one in several thousand soldiers has chosen to even try out for this unit. It's incredibly elite. It's, you know, something probably akin to our Navy SEALs, probably even more selective. The training for it is grueling. And the unit, or Sayeret Matkal, as it's known in Israel, is responsible for carrying out these very secretive high-level counterterrorism missions. And so they're known for selecting people who are not just physically fit and can carry themselves well in the battlefield, but who are also really intellectually gifted and can kind of help plot out these very high-level secretive missions that don't even necessarily involve any weaponry.
Not that the Israeli government's really going to tell you a lot in answer to such questions, but, I mean, was there a cyber terrorism or counter-cyber terrorism component to this?
Well, you know, at the time, I don't think so. You know, at the time, it was really, cyber terrorism was certainly something that people were talking about, but at the time that Danny served in the unit, you know, keep in mind, this was just before the Americans went into Iraq. Israel was right on the cusp of that. In fact, while Danny was serving in the IDF, Iraq launched Scud missiles on Israel, which is the first attack.
This is the first Iraq war we're talking about, yeah.
Yes, exactly, the first Iraq war. So, I mean, at the time, you know, the conversation was really about, was about terrorism and about Hamas and about Al-Qaeda. And I did go to Israel to report the book, but part of the code of secrecy of Sayeret Matkal is it is absolutely a code of silence to your grave, that you never ever divulge any details of any missions. The ones that have been leaked to the press have been, you know, extremely high profile. But so I was never really able to find out any details of what Danny did, but I do know that during the time in which he served, which is 3 years, he undertook some really probably extraordinary high-level missions to capture, kidnap, or kill terrorists.
I get the sense at this point, and our audience should too, that Danny Lewin did very little halfway other than perhaps actually attending school, but it seems like that whatever he did, he seemed to throw himself completely into it.
Yeah, that's what really fascinated me about writing about this character. You know, in some ways he seemed to me so much larger than life. You know, it's just how I kept asking myself, how could someone who is so brilliant, and, you know, we'll go on to talk probably a little bit about his time at MIT, but, you know, you talk to the top computer scientists and mathematicians in the country, and they'll say, yes, Danny Lewin was a genius. So that comes from them, not from me as the writer. But then you have this incredible dichotomy or the juxtaposition of this young soldier who was so physically fit, and a warrior, you know, on the battlefield. And the two just didn't seem to fit together very well until I started writing the book. And I think that's when I understood very well how pivotal the time in Israel was for Danny. You know, he was so mad about the move, but in a sense, moving there, when you already he was someone who already had this innate drive and, like I said, this incredible speed to his life, and he never did anything halfway. And then to land in Israel, a country in which life is very intense, you know, if you live there and you grow up there, you live always with the sense of, you know, anything can happen at any moment. You're living under the shadow of terrorism. And so I think moving there for him just really, like, ignited the fire in him. And from there, he just took off. And as you said, absolutely, he never did anything halfway. Everything for him was going above and beyond, and then beyond that point, you know, to the point where people would say, why is he even doing this? He's already proved himself. But it wasn't about that. He had to prove it to himself, and that was definitely like an innate character trait that was really fun to write about.
So, Molly, given the level of commitment he clearly had to this anti-terrorism unit, why did he leave the military?
Well, you know, I think he was excited about serving, and, you know, hanging out with all these guys in the Army and telling all these tales was really fun for him. But there's no doubt in my mind that, you know, really for him, intellectual pursuits and taking on, you know, huge unwieldy problems in math and science was more interesting and more inspiring to him than serving in the Army. I wouldn't say more, but I mean, it was something that he saw himself doing for the rest of his life. And so, you know, I read some letters of his during his time in the Army where he expressed interest already, even as young, you know, a teenager, in going to MIT one day. He sort of had this idea in his head that MIT would be the place to go to study computer science and math. And, I mean, of course it was. It was the best, arguably, in the whole world. But, you know, he sort of talked a big game at that point in time. But I think in reality, he really did always have it in him to pursue academic and intellectual, you know, sort of more studious types of things. And so, and that's really the way he grew up as well. I mean, his parents were extremely proud of his service in the Army, but they grew up in a household that really thrived on intellectual pursuits, you know, where they talked a lot about math problems and science, and they challenged each other. And so I think that was in his blood too. And I think he really began to feel the itch after a couple of years in the Army. And that's when he applied to the Technion, which is the best school for engineering and science in Israel. They often call it the MIT of Israel. And then went on from there, where he was the best student of the year, of course, to apply to MIT, and was admitted to MIT, and in fact, the top 10 grad schools in the country for those subjects, and decided to go there.
Journalist Molly Knight Raskin is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. We're talking about her book about Danny Lewin. It's called No Better Time, The Brief Remarkable Life of Danny Lewin, the genius who transformed the Internet. A remarkable young man who figured out ways to make the Internet go faster and resulted in the Internet that we really know today in a lot of ways. He died in the September 11th terrorist attacks. We'll get to that down the road. And we were talking about how he got so brilliant at computers in the first place. You can join us on the Exchange at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area. In the Rogue Valley, it's 541-552-6782. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So, Molly, if you would describe the scene when Danny Lewin first met Tom Leighton at MIT.
Well, yeah, this is a scene that that I love to kind of recreate in my head, because I think for both of them, or I know for both of them, it was truly a life-altering moment. One of those moments, you know, you look back on and you say, that's when everything changed. And you can really draw that point back to this moment when Danny Lewin, this really charismatic, energetic tour de force, if you will, from Israel, a student, arrived at MIT in the fall of 1996. And he arrived there largely in part because he found a book at the library that really excited him. And it was a book that, I mean, honestly, if I read the title, I don't think anybody would recognize what the topic was. It was very high-level book of theoretical math, and it was by a professor named S. Thomas Leighton at MIT, and he was already, he was 15 years older than Danny and already just absolutely sort of premier in his field, had written this seminal book on parallel algorithms and distributed systems. And if you think that's a mouthful, that's not even the real title of the book. But it was basically, you know, again, using theoretical math, which was, which is really an obscure language, to figure out problems in distributed systems. And the Internet is a distributed system. It doesn't go from A to B. Information moves from A to B to C and kind of all over the place. And so he was really interested in using math and algorithms or recipes or instructions using math to figure out some of these problems that the Internet was bringing up for us. And so Danny arrived at MIT that fall, and he was absolutely so excited to meet Tom Leighton. This was the professor that he'd read about. He knew all of his work, you know, kind of by heart, and arrives on campus really eager to impress this professor, and literally barreled into his office one day. And as Tom Leighton describes it, you know, he kind of took one look at him, and his first impression was not, oh, wow, this is the next MIT genius. It was kind of, oh, this guy has an unusual amount of energy for a math student at MIT. But he was really drawn to him, and it was very soon thereafter that the two of them began having these conversations that were just completely life-altering for both of them. I mean, I think they realized early on that despite the age difference, despite the difference in character, they spoke this language of theoretical math that is absolutely so rarefied and beautiful and difficult to understand that it was kind of like, you know, best analogy I could think of would be speaking some archaic, you know, language that doesn't exist anymore and meeting somebody who really understood what you were talking about. And even more so was as excited as Danny was about these topics. And so the two of them met, and before long, it was just kind of the fireworks went off. They were, you know, Tom Leighton was his mentor, but then really became his intellectual partner.
The MIT DNA, I gather, is goes back several generations of the Internet. It's pretty much been there since the Internet's beginning, or its precursors, too, for that matter, hasn't it?
Yes, that's, you know, another thing that I think very few people know about the Internet. I mean, or even if we know it, we don't think of it today because it's so different. You know, now it's our whole life. It's the way we shop, the way we watch media, the way we communicate. But even, you know, back in the 90s, the Internet was just sort of exploding as something that, you know, we had universal access to. But the Internet had its beginnings in scientific and academic environments. And, you know, the Internet was actually started as a project of the United States government, of the Department of Defense, and it was begun at MIT, where a group of brilliant MIT scientists started creating this system where we could exchange information through computers from one place to another. And at the time, again, it wasn't something that people were thinking about as really having this incredible universal application. But when Danny landed there in the 90s, you know, that research definitely sort of spawned a whole next generation of computer scientists at MIT who were then working to turn the Internet into something even bigger and better. And so, you know, when Danny got there, it was a really exciting time. And this was the mid-90s, so we're talking, you know, the birth of Amazon, the birth of, you know, Apple as we know it today, the birth of so many of these huge dot-com companies, eBay, et cetera, that really defined that first dot-com boom. So it was a really exciting time. And the history there is, you know, so steeped in history and the great works of these early founders of the Internet that I think it was just very exciting.
I did notice the mention of Al Gore in the book. Just to set the record straight, I'm glad you did. What did he do?
Well, Al Gore, you know, contrary to I'm going to call it the popular belief, but the story, it did not invent the Internet. But he was, the reason I bring him up in the book is because he does deserve credit what credit was due. And Al Gore was a very early supporter of technology and legislation to support it. And so he was very early on responsible for the passage of a bill in Congress that really supported the Internet and gave it, you know, gave a lot of these pioneers of the Internet the support and the, you know, the financial and just legislative support that really paved the way for the information superhighway. And so he steered a bill through Congress that was really pivotal, which was, you know, and I think that's sort of where the confusion lies. But he was definitely a pivotal player in the movement from the Internet as an academic experiment into this explosive commercial enterprise.
So at the time that Danny Lewin began doing his work with the Internet through the lab at MIT, there were some warnings of impending doom for the Internet. What was the general state of things that Danny Lewin and his group set out to address?
Well, there was, and the problem can really be summed up pretty easily. At the time, you know, the real issue or challenge the Internet faced in growth or universal access or commercial explosion was the fact that when you logged onto the Internet, you being any user in any library or any home or any institution, you often or almost always face a lag time or a wait time if you're trying to access a really popular website. And this was sort of such a huge problem that it had various names, but the one I use in the book is the worldwide wait. Instead of the World Wide Web, people were waiting, and these wait times, I mean, certainly also in reference to today where we can log on and access anything in a split second, were seemingly interminable. You know, you log on, and we can all remember if we lived through it, dialing in with the modem connection and hearing that straining and then the chirping and the beeping.
Yeah.
And then you'd get that note that would often say, you know, please try again later. The server's busy. And, you know, it was just one little note. It was one or two extra minutes. But that lag time or that worldwide wait could kill any internet business. You know, if you couldn't get through to that website at that moment, well, you were just going to move on and go to a website you could actually access. So the problem of the worldwide wait, the traffic, you know, all these congested highways that was sort of a wild web inside the internet.
All right, I'll pick up the story on the other side of a break. The guest is Molly Knight Raskin. Her book is No Better Time, The Brief Remarkable Life of Danny Lewin, the genius who transformed the internet. We're finding out about Danny Lewin's life, which ended tragically on September 11th, 2001. We'll come back and talk more with Molly about the book and about Danny, and you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange when we come back in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about the man who made the internet go faster. Danny Lewin was his name, an American who moved with his family to Israel in his high school years and served in the Israeli military and came back to America to go to MIT after graduating from the Israeli counterpart of MIT. Danny Lewin, his name. He is the subject of the book No Better Time, The Brief Remarkable Life of Danny Lewin, the genius who transformed the internet. Brief because he died in the September 11th terrorist attacks. Journalist Molly Knight Raskin is the author of the book and our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. You can join our discussion, 800-838-3760, anywhere in our listening area. In the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org. So the worldwide wait was the issue that that Danny was addressing, and Danny and his partners at the lab at MIT. And so what they really worked – you're very patient of the book about working us through algorithms. I guess this is the time to talk about what those are.
Well, I had to be patient because I started off this book with no background in math or computer science. I was an English major in college, and I had no idea what an algorithm was, I will admit. You know, I understood it on a very basic level. But what I attempt to do in the book, and I hope I do successfully, is to make the book a story about this character and to address the algorithms and explain them, but do so in a way that is really totally in layman's terms. In other words, you know, my grandmother could understand it, or in this case, you know, my great aunt, okay, and she did. So, you know, really just an algorithm, I think, is a scary word for a lot of people, and it scared and intimidated me at first, but it's really just a set of instructions. So we use algorithms every day, whether or not we're aware of it. If you bake a cake, you use an algorithm. And it's basically just a set of instructions, and there are various sets of instructions which can all result in the same outcome. So, you know, there are different, for example, sets of directions you can use to get to the same place. And so what Danny and Tom Layton set out to do was to use this set of algorithms to program software, intelligent software, that would essentially tell the internet how to route content from one place to the other in a way that would avoid the traffic jams or circumvent these areas in which data was getting all jammed up and causing websites to crash. And, you know, if you look at like a set of file drawers in a file cabinet, really that's the way they did it, which was instead of just making all the information, stuffing everything into drawer A, B, C, and D, it was using math to figure out when more information was added to each drawer, how you would balance it all out without essentially messing everything up and exploding one drawer and having to start all over again.
So really what he did was he figured out ways to almost juice up the speed of the drivers or the cars or whatever you want to call them on the information superhighway in the sense that it could see obstacles much farther out in advance and then move around them, look for the detours that were obvious, so the saving time for the information to get where it needed to go.
That's right. I mean, you know, really what, you know, there are many things you could call it. I mean, I like to call it sort of the magic layer of the internet. But what it was kind of its own. They created their own superhighway. The company created its own superhighway. And by placing these servers in global data centers around the world and then using these mathematical patterns or algorithms to route the traffic, so whenever the data would hit these servers, these intelligent servers would tell the data where to go, and it would be a route that was fast, much faster than the route that all the other content was going. And so, you know, what they invented was basically what you now call a content delivery service, but their content delivery network. They offered companies a way to circumvent the traffic. Like, we will build you your own highway to get your information from A to B, and you're going to pay for it, but that's going to pay off when your users don't leave your website for a faster, better one.
I haven't talked much about Danny's personal life at this point, other than his schooling and his service in the military. But given that we've already established that he didn't do anything halfway, when he met the woman of his dreams, he also proposed to her within a few months, I think. And by the time they got to MIT, it was Danny, his wife, and two kids, wasn't it?
That's right. It was also a very intense personal life. So, you know, it isn't uncommon in Israel to marry early, but Danny did meet the woman of his dreams when he was about 20 years old. She was still serving in the Army at the time, and it was a great story of sort of a weekend date. I think the first time they met, he was in his uniform for the Army, went out for a night with a woman named Anne, who was Belgian, and just about the same age, maybe a year or two older. We met, and we fell madly in love, and they were married within, I think, it's just a couple of months, and had their first child within, I think, that year. So, yeah, by the time he went to MIT as a student, he was, as a graduate student, he brought over also his wife, Anne, and their two little boys. One of them was just a newborn when he landed at MIT. So it was also unusual to be a student with that at MIT's most exclusive computer science and artificial intelligence lab, and then to have a wife and two little babies and to have just come out of an army of service in the army.
Yeah, and, you know, given the fact that he had a family to support, it wasn't like they were really in the best of financial circumstances. So Danny and company figured out some way to start shooting for some income from what they were doing at the lab at MIT. What was their avenue?
Well, you're right. I mean, Danny was like any graduate student, or like so many, he was struggling. He didn't have a lot of financial support from family. He was doing it on his own with his wife. She was also in school. And they had two little kids, and they were living in a tiny dormitory apartment. And they really struggled. In fact, described to me, his wife, you know, waking up at night and really sweating out how they were going to pay the bills. So they were in a very stressful place. Danny really didn't envision anything at that point beyond, you know, a life like Tom Layton. I mean, he aspired to become a professor at MIT, which to him at the time would have been the greatest thing in the world. And he was definitely on that track. But when he and Tom wrote this set of algorithms, they realized very quickly in speaking to friends and others at MIT and, you know, the business school at MIT at Sloan, that what they had was something that wasn't just great on paper. It would actually be practically applicable. Like, it could really change the way the internet worked. And, you know, I think they in some ways almost surprised themselves. And they set out to patent the technology. And then through some very convincing friends or relationships, they decided to start the company and incorporate. And that happened in 1998. And then it was just, an absolutely explosive story of the company they created, Akamai Technologies, in 1998. Again, right out of MIT, there were just a couple of employees when they incorporated, and it took off. It became really like the sensation. I mean, the fourth largest IPO, or initial public offering, of that first dot-com boom. And that happened so quickly that it was like the blink of an eye, you know, a nine-month explosion from dorm room to incredibly successful company.
And so but he became, I guess the terminology he used was zillionaire pretty much overnight, right?
Yeah, well, you know, he was also prone to a little bit of hyperbole, just like his physical personality. He also liked to talk big. And he talked a lot about becoming a zillionaire, but it was really time and depth. He really wanted to just do something great with his life. And I don't think he ever expected to become as rich, or ever even dreamed of becoming as rich as he did. But yes, the company, because, you know, it really just created, they were at the right time and place. And not only did they have a great idea that really worked, and a business plan that was sustainable, but they were right at the cusp of that dot-com boom. And when they exploded so, you know, the sort of domino effect was that everybody who worked for them at the time, the company was small, but students at MIT, you know, friends and family who were given shares in the company when they incorporated, were worth millions, billions of dollars. And Danny and Tom Layton, professor and student, were literally overnight capabilities.
Well, and you talk about the fact that it was the right place and time. And the book, in fact, is called No Better Time. Was it a narrow window, do you think, when you consider all the other circumstances? I mean, things had to come together like money, and there were a couple of false starts where it looked like it was going to come through and didn't before it finally did. Do you think, like, 2 years either way, Akamai might not have made it?
Oh, I think a couple of months either way, to be honest. You know, Akamai wasn't the only game in town. They were very much aware of that at the time. I mean, thanks in part to, you know, Dan's fiercely competitive spirit, they took out a lot of their competitors in the early days of the company. But, you know, keep in mind that, as you say, this company, you know, despite the fact that, as we talked about, everything that Danny Ruin touched seemed to turn to gold, and he seemed to succeed in almost every arena of his life, getting this company off the ground was no easy task. And there were plenty of people who looked him in the eye and said, what you're doing is completely crazy and it's totally not going to work. And, you know, but they had enough believers who were important players in the internet industry that they were able to take off and get the support they needed to show everybody that they had the best solution to speed up the internet. But yeah, they weren't the only game in town. There were other companies trying to do what they were doing, using different technologies to do what they were doing. And I really think if they hadn't created that company and gone public as fast as they had in that short window that was less than a year, the story could have been extremely different. So I think it wasn't a matter of a year or two, probably even a couple of months.
This is 1998 then, right around the time of the Monica Lewinsky scandal. Did that actually play a part in Akamai's success?
Well, it absolutely did. If you remember, that was really the first time in our, you know, history, you know, in terms of news and culture, that we turned to the internet for information. You know, prior to that, it was newspapers, radio, and television. And we really weren't looking to the internet like we do today, at least for news alerts, for breaking news, to follow big stories. The internet just didn't support it yet. I mean, there were certainly websites that were up and running in CNN.com and some ABC and all the major networks were already had presence online. But the idea of sort of going en masse to a website to find out information about some massive news event just really wasn't there yet. And the reason for that was because the internet really didn't work well enough yet for that to be an option. And so the Monica Lewinsky affair scandal broke. And, of course, we were all scrambling for these incredibly salacious details. And Congress made this decision to release the information and to release it on floppy disks, which were then scurried around and loaded onto the Internet. But the problem was that everybody started to log on to these websites that were offering the information, and they couldn't access it. The websites were crashing. The data was moving so slowly that people couldn't get the information. And it was really, I think, the first time that we as a nation sort of said, we have this technology at our fingertips and it's not working. It's not working the way that we, you know, these visionaries see it working. It's got this great potential, but there's still really something holding it back. And that's when, you know, talk about timing, but, you know, a lot of folks looked at what Danny and Tom and their partners were doing and said, okay, maybe we should give these guys a chance because nothing else is working.
And, you know, it's there's an irony here, and it's a rather cruel one at that, that the next really big story, it can be argued, well, after the 2000 election, of course, was the September 11th terrorist attacks, and Danny died in those. You describe him as the first victim of 9/11. Explain, please.
Well, it is a tragic irony. Danny, you know, by 2001, the company, you know, had exploded, then the bubble had burst, and so the company was struggling a bit, but had a plan to succeed and to sustain itself throughout the dot-com crash. But Danny was working around the clock, and that year, I think he had made something like 30 trips to California on this same flight that he took from Logan Airport to Los Angeles. So the morning of September 11th was really not unlike, you know, many of Danny's mornings. He got up early, he raced from his home, said goodbye to his wife and kids, raced from his home to the airport, hopped on that flight, which was American Airlines Flight 11, that departed on time from Logan. And tragically, that was the very first flight to be hijacked that morning of September 11th, set off the attacks, was slammed into the North Tower of the World Trade Center, killing everybody on board. I say he's the first victim. Now, I am careful to say that he was almost certainly the first victim, and I don't say it with 100% certainty because we can never know. We will never know exactly what happened on that flight. We can only know what we can gather from the details that the 9/11 Commission so carefully reported in the years following the attacks. But what we do know for certain is that Danny got on that flight that morning. We know he was seated in business class. We know that he was seated within arm's reach of Mohammed Atta, who was the ringleader of the attacks that day, that he, at some point during the flight, after the hijackers had begun taking over the plane, we know from a flight attendant who radioed down and whose call was transcribed that the passenger in Danny's seat rose from his seat and engaged in a struggle with one of the terrorists. And during that struggle, he was killed from behind by a terrorist who was seated directly behind him and wielding a knife. And, you know, again, I say almost certainly because we don't know. You know, maybe somebody else, maybe we don't know another detail. Maybe else somebody else was killed on board the flight that day. But that happened well before the September 11th attacks were, you know, had really happened. And it happened before the flight crashed into the Trade Center.
Well, there's obviously a great legacy that Danny Lewin left behind as well. I mean, we can thank a lot of what goes on the Internet now. Thank Danny for that, and it's well outlined in the book. The book is No Better Time, The Brief Remarkable Life of Danny Lewin, the Genius Who Transformed the Internet. Molly Knight Raskin wrote it and joined us today in The Exchange. Molly, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It was really a pleasure.
All right, good to talk to you. Tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange at 8 o'clock, we'll talk about market research being made available for small companies in the Rogue Valley. We'll talk to the folks at the Osher Lifelong Learning Institute, Ali, about keeping seniors' minds sharp. Then we'll talk to Daniel Siddiqui at 9 o'clock. 50 jobs in 50 states in 1 year. How did he do it? We will find out. That's all tomorrow on the Jefferson Exchange. Our producer and today's engineer, Charlotte Duran. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening, and please have a great day.